My name is Joel Tickner. Good afternoon, and welcome to the first in a series of conference calls that we'll be organizing on the topic of alternatives assessment. And what we thought was the first call should be an overview, an introduction to the concepts of alternatives assessment for informed substitution. I'll be doing the webinar today with Pam Eliason, who is the Deputy Director of the Massachusetts Toxic Use Reduction Institute. I'm Joel Tickner. I'm a faculty member in the Department of Community Health and Sustainability and a director of the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell. The overview of the presentation will start with a little background of why we've started this interagency effort around alternatives assessment, why even think about alternatives assessment, what do we mean by alternatives assessment, some basic history, and then jump into what do we mean, what is an alternatives assessment process, and then end with some discussion. So last year we hosted in March of last year an interagency meeting on alternatives assessment that was attended by 40 experts from 12 federal and 7 state agencies. And this group of experts came together recognizing that there were numerous efforts at the federal, state, and local levels on alternatives assessment. And there were some areas of collaboration and discussion, but not in a very thoughtful or coordinated manner. So what we realized is states, local governments, federal government struggling with similar challenges around getting good access to toxicological data, understanding what chemicals are in what products, and understanding those similar challenges, but a need for better coordination. Yet, were some differences in approaches between agencies and how they were undertaking alternatives assessments, their toxicological criteria for comparing alternatives that would benefit from greater enhanced collaboration. And then, obviously, incredible opportunities for sharing expertise and resources that could enhance the adoption of alternatives reduction opportunities. Let me stop there and just ask that everyone put their phones on mute. So that we can limit the amount of external noise. So from that 2011 meeting, we decided to continue education and dialogue that's supported by an informal advisory group. That group has a mission, which is to advance the practice of alternatives assessment across state, federal, and local agencies through networking, sharing of opportunities and experiences, developing of common tools and approaches, and then creation, ultimately, of a community of practice for alternatives assessment. So why alternatives assessment? Why even talk about alternatives assessment? And many of us have come to alternatives assessment through a recognition that the current way that decisions are made on chemicals is extremely slow, resource-intensive, and often reactionary. It responds to the chemical concern of the day in a chemical-by-chemical basis where we determine an acceptable level of risk or a threshold value that represents acceptable risk and then identify exposure controls that may or may not be effective in reducing that risk below that threshold level, but may not address other parts of the exposure profile. Maybe one addresses the problem in the manufacturing facility, but may not address a problem later on at the use phase or even the manufacturing phase of a chemical. We know that the data on toxicity, use, and exposure are extremely limited. It's a general problem that we face in chemicals risk assessment and alternatives assessment. And often in the types of debates that agencies face, while there are uncertainties, which there always are in the toxicological and exposure and use database, the default assumption is no action until those debates are resolved and we get to a deeper level of understanding of the mechanism of or pharmacokinetic model, whereas an opportunity may exist to actually jump ahead and find alternatives. Another area is often the focus on a narrow jurisdiction, for example, looking at a chemical in a particular product, whether it be a food product or in a workplace or in a consumer product, may leave out other parts of that exposure profile that may transition risks from one place to another. So if we're acting, for example, on a chemical that poses a worker concern or a consumer concern, and then finding an alternative that may actually be much more toxic in the manufacturing phase but less toxic at the use phase, we could actually trade off risks without that kind of decent collaboration and coordination. So let's see here. Those slides aren't working well. So the national conversation, the CDC National Conversation on Chemical Exposures, an effort that the CDC undertook over a two-year period to bring together stakeholders across from the nonprofit sector, workers, industry, and government to find options to better characterize and prevent chemical exposures, focused on the challenges of the current approach to chemicals management, which is very chemical by chemical and reactionary, and the need for really identifying and advancing the context of safer alternatives. So it's important here to talk about what do we mean by alternatives assessment. And alternatives assessment is defined as a process for identifying and comparing potential chemical and non-chemical alternatives that could replace chemicals or technologies of concern on the basis of their hazards, performance, and economic viability. A part of that process of alternatives assessment is what we might call comparative chemicals assessment, which is comparing chemical alternatives on the basis of their intrinsic chemical hazards. And the ultimate goal here is informed substitution, which is a considered thoughtful transition from a chemical of particular concern to safer chemicals or non-chemical alternatives. And we can define a safer alternative as an option, including the option of not doing that activity anymore, that's healthier for humans or the environment than the existing means of meeting that need. Whereas a safer chemical is a chemical that, because of its inherent chemical and physical properties, exhibits a lower propensity to persist in the environment, accumulate in the organisms, and induce adverse effects in toxicological studies. And it's important to compare or contrast the idea of alternatives assessment with green chemistry. When we talk about alternatives assessment, we're generally talking about evaluating options to meet a particular functional use of a chemical that are on the market today. We're comparing those that are on the market or maybe near on the horizon, whereas chemistry is really the molecular design. It's the molecular design of chemical products and processes that reduce or eliminate the use and generation of hazardous substances through their manufacture, use, and disposal. They're very intertwined terms, but we generally think about green chemistry as the design of new molecules, whereas alternatives assessment looks at existing molecules and comparing them. Now, the types of processes that we'll talk about for alternatives assessment are very critical to the design of new chemicals as well. So what are the benefits here of moving towards an alternatives assessment approach? First is the move from what we might call the problem sphere to the solution sphere. So rather than simply identifying and characterizing problems to a greater degree, is there a way that we can identify innovative, cost-effective solutions that would actually support innovation, support job creation, and lead us more systemically towards safer chemistry rather than simply responding to the chemical problem of the day? Can we think about this in a much more holistic possibility? Alternatives assessment, because it is about both the assessment and the implementation, provides a great opportunity for stakeholder engagement in solving problems, and it allows agencies to use those regulatory, discretionary, or collaborative powers to encourage action, preventive action, to find substitutes, even where the science isn't perfect to reach some kind of legally defined threshold of a substantial risk to make a regulatory decision. You may be able to identify alternatives that would shift into a solution without having to actually regulate that problem in the first place. It also leads to better product design. So it's a focus on innovation so that we continuously trying to find options that would move from problem chemicals to safer chemicals and really ensure that as we are making those transitions, we're avoiding risk trade-offs. And ultimately, alternatives assessment can help us focus on the whole of a problem. For example, if we take solar panels, which are an important solution for climate change and climate action, can we integrate the toxics consideration so that when we're addressing an energy problem, we're also addressing a toxics problem, so that there are win-win opportunities for innovation that address multiple problems at the same time? So a history here, it's important to say that alternatives assessment has a long history in areas of chemical prioritization and substitution. It is the top of the industrial hygiene hierarchy of controls. It's the basis of the top of the pollution prevention hierarchy as well, which is substitution. So substituting a problem chemical with a safer alternative is the most effective long-term approach to dealing with a chemical hazard. Now, we have lots of consideration of substitution in government policies, but in those policies, there's few requirements to actually conduct an alternatives assessment, which is the process of evaluating those chemicals, a thoughtful process for evaluating those chemicals. So, long history here, it dates back to the 1960s in Sweden, for example, the Nordic countries, particularly Sweden, addressing chemical substitution as a key way to address chemical hazards. The National Environmental Protection Act really solidified this concept of alternatives assessment in the context of environmental impact assessments, where requires these assessments of all reasonable alternatives, including no action. The Endangered Species Act requires consideration of reasonable and prudent alternatives. The Montreal Protocol established what are called chemical technical options committees to review alternatives for ozone-depleting substances. In the European context, both in occupational and several environmental areas, for example, in cosmetics, there are standards that or regulations, directives that require substitution of certain chemicals of high concern, primarily carcinogens, mutagens, and reproductive toxicants, based on their hazard classification. This is both in the cosmetics directive and in the carcinogens and chemical agents directives. REACH solidified at a different level the idea of chemical substitution. So the REACH registration evaluation authorization of chemicals regulation in Europe, which came into force in 2007, requires authorization for firms wishing to use what are called substances of very high concern. There's about 60 of those substances now identified, and I believe 20 of them subject to reporting for authorization at this point, and those substances have to be substituted if they cannot be adequately controlled, and if a company is requesting a substitution or an authorization, they have to undertake an alternatives assessment. Also, article manufacturers and retailers must identify these substances of very high control concern in products. And the European Chemicals Agency has published a guidance on alternatives assessment. That guidance is at the link that is on your screen. In the United States context, there's been several drivers of substitution and alternatives assessment in the chemicals arena. The Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement of 1976 identified the discharge of toxic substances and toxic amounts be prohibited, and that the discharge of any and all persistent toxic substances be virtually eliminated. Pollution Prevention Act of 1990 also established prevention at the top of the hierarchy of pollution control. So an EPA in the 1990s undertook numerous activities around implementation of the Pollution Prevention Act. One of those was the Cleaner Technology Substitutes Assessment. More recently, a federal executive order has pushed the General Services Administration to look at less toxic and non-toxic product, and also Department of Defense purchasing has moved in that direction. And then chemical plant security and process safety management are really focusing on this area of inherent safety. So looking at alternatives that would inherently reduce chemical accident hazards. And then lastly, in TSCA reform, the Toxic Substances Control Act discussions of revisions to the 1976 Act, the Safe Chemicals Act of 2001, has several provisions for alternatives assessment in it. Just to give you some examples of some of the work that's happening at the state level, the California Safe Drinking Water and Toxic Enforcement Act, Prop 65, prohibits discharging chemicals that have carcinogenic or reproductive toxicity into sources of drinking water, which is a driver for substitution. Several states have pollution prevention planning acts. Massachusetts is one of the pioneering ones. The Massachusetts Toxic Use Reduction Act of 1990 requires both an understanding and an accounting for how materials flow through a manufacturing process, and every 2 years, a planning process to evaluate alternatives that would reduce chemical use and waste. And many states have undertaken single chemical bans or group of chemical bans, from mercury to the polybrominated diphenyl ethers to phthalates to lead to bisphenol A, and several states have integrated more comprehensive policies that both integrate chemical prioritization, labeling of chemicals of concern, for example, to children, and now chemical restrictions or alternatives assessment provisions. Just to give you a couple of examples of what is happening right now, the EPA has done extensive work through the Design for Environment program, working in partnership with industry, environmental groups, and academic institutions to advance this idea of informed substitution and incentives for adoption. Two key programs that EPA is advancing through DFE are the Safer Product Labeling Program, using EPA's tools for chemical assessment that they've had for many years in the New Chemicals Program and their expertise to evaluate programs and label those that meet the program standards, and their Alternatives Assessment, where they're helping companies for specific chemicals of concern, for example, brominated diphenyl ethers or bisphenol A, identify and review alternatives to those chemicals that are of concern, and the EPA website is there for the DFE program. NIOSH, through its Prevention Through Design program, which is focused on addressing occupational safety and health needs by eliminating hazards and minimizing risks to workers through their life cycle of work processes, has worked for many years on health hazard banding as an approach to addressing barriers to minimizing chemical risk when there aren't exposure limits, and to promote prioritization, risk reduction, and informed substitution in the design phase. And NIOSH just held a meeting in November of last year to develop hazard categorizations and bans for different endpoints that can be useful in determining appropriate control or prevention options. Washington State, through their Safe Chemical Children's Safe Products Act of 2008, both prioritized the chemical universe of chemicals in the state to identify 2,000 high-priority chemicals, and then in 2010 published a list of about 66 chemicals of high concern for children. As of August 2012, manufacturers of those children products must report to the Department of Ecology if their products contain those chemicals. And then in 2012, amendments, just this month, amendments have been proposed to require alternatives assessment for those high concern to children chemicals. And the Department of Ecology has initiated a stakeholder alternatives assessment dialogue to start developing tools for that can be used by a wide range of stakeholders and processes for alternatives assessment, and the link to their process is there. The Massachusetts Toxic Use Reduction Program in 2005, following a state legislative budget request that requested that the Massachusetts Toxic Use Reduction Institute look at alternatives to five chemicals of concern: lead, formaldehyde, perchloroethylene, hexavalent chromium, and DEHP. For each of those chemicals, they did an analysis of the significant uses of those chemicals in manufacturing, and then did an alternatives assessment involving stakeholders across sectors in those alternatives assessment processes. It was a very successful approach that ended up in a very pioneering report that laid out a process for alternatives assessment. California has initiated back in 2007 its major green chemistry initiative, which is focused on education, stakeholder engagement, and scientific review around advancing green chemistry in the state of California. In 2008, the state legislature, in part based on recommendations from a science panel as part of the Green Chemistry Initiative passed two laws, AB 1879, which requires the state through the Department of Toxic Substances Control to identify chemicals of concern in products, to evaluate alternatives, and to specify appropriate regulatory responses to those concerns. And then SB 509, which works with the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, OEHA, requires the state to establish a public online toxics information clearinghouse on the hazards of chemicals found in products. 2011, well, back in 2010 and again in 2011, DTSC published its draft Safer Consumer Products Regulation to create a process for both prioritizing chemicals and products of concern and analyzing alternatives and the regulatory responses that would come out with it. It's a very detailed process. A lot of the materials, including presentations, stakeholder dialogues, are on the DTSC website. And then some of the European work, we've been working with a project out of the European Union, funded by the European, called the European Substitution Portal, SubSport, which brings together mostly academic and labor and environmental stakeholders into the development of a portal of alternatives and alternatives assessment tools for substances of very high concern identified in the REACH process. And then many NGOs, one of them in particular, Clean Production Action, has developed a logic approach for the process of alternatives assessment. And in several NGOs or non-governmental organizations, another one, Green Blue, has developed a database of alternatives for certain chemicals in cleaning chemical formulations. And then lastly, there's many business efforts. We coordinate a group called the Green Chemistry and Commerce Council, which is a group of industries across sectors that are trying to advance the adoption of safer chemicals in their products. And many companies, including Dell, Staples, Walmart, have undertaken efforts to both prioritize their chemical universes, develop restricted substances lists, reformulate products, and then come up with policies to evaluate and transition towards safer chemicals. And there's some great work in that arena. So let me pass now to Pam Eliason, who's going to take the next step of this presentation.
Thanks, Joel. Can everybody hear me? Can you hear me, Joel?
Yeah.
Since everybody else is muted nicely. Before we go, do you want to address this question Jean asked, if we could offer any discrete examples of successful substitution, or should we wait till the end?
Why don't we wait towards the end, but Pam, as you go through yours, maybe you bring up an example from the Tory perspective.
Okay. And now, am I sharing this?
Yeah, it's
shared. Are you going to... Okay, so I can move it? No, I can't. Wait.
Yep.
Everybody hold on. Sorry about this. Here we go. Let's see.
I'm off.
Okay.
You're on.
I've got it. Okay, great. Thanks a lot, Joel. So I just want to remind us all the definition of alternatives assessment. You know, it's a process that we go through to find potential alternatives that could replace chemicals or technologies of concern. And it's important to point out that alternatives assessment does not limit itself to only chemical-to-chemical substitutions, but also is a process that can be used to find material or process changes that could result in a viable alternative. When we do alternatives assessments, we make the basis for finding a suitable alternative based on the hazards, but also on performance and economic feasibility of the alternative. So I'll get into that a little bit. The goal of the process itself is to reduce your risk, but to do so not by focusing on controlling exposure, rather by reducing the hazard inherent in the process or in the chemistry. And an important point, and one that can be a sticky issue as we move through it, is to use the process to be sure to avoid regrettable substitutions. Now, when we're doing an alternatives assessment, we can go through this process and identify potential alternatives. The challenge to federal and state government agencies certainly is to get industry to actually adopt those safer alternatives. And so that's something that I think is a conversation that this group can have together, how best to promote adoption. So alternatives assessment is a kind of a stepwise process, but it's intended to be more iterative. And so it really focuses on the function of the chemical of concern for a specific use, and with an eye towards reducing the hazard associated with that. A key question that we like to see asked in any alternatives assessment process right up front is the chemical necessary, and more importantly perhaps, is the function that this chemical of concern is providing, is that necessary? It's a very high-level view look and question that needs to be asked, and one that in Massachusetts toxic use reduction planners routinely use as they move forward. So when we're looking for alternatives, remember we're not just looking at chemical-to-chemical drop-in replacements. We may also be looking at production process changes, changes in product design, or changes in how you can achieve the function that you've identified as being necessary, and whether or not there are any new solutions, either chemical or systemic solutions that might be able to achieve the desired result of moving away from the chemicals of concern. So what I'm going to do is walk through the process of alternatives assessment. And what you see here is a graphic that the Interstate Chemicals Clearinghouse created for its shared Wiki, which really is an opportunity for states to share information on how they go through the process of alternatives assessment and also to share tools. And so you see the website there. If anybody wants to kind of go to that website and dig in a little bit deeper, that would be great. One of the very first steps for alternatives assessment is to really be clear that engaging with the stakeholders, identifying who the important stakeholders are and engaging with them is really critical to, especially from a government perspective, to successfully achieving an alternatives assessment that can lead to adoption of safer alternatives. So throughout the whole process, you should be thinking about who are the stakeholders who matter. How can I be working with them, gathering data from them, hearing from them what their concerns might be in order to have a more effective process? Oops, I'm pointing. Sorry, folks. Here we go. Okay. So let's go step by step. First, in any process, you want to really be clear about what it is that you're trying to achieve. Now, from a regulatory perspective, depending on who you are and what your sort of legislative demands are, you may be looking at a chemical of concern that you're evaluating whether or not to ban or control the use of the chemical. Alternatively, you may be looking, the goal of the process for you may be simply to initiate, to move the economy in your jurisdiction towards a safer chemical economy, so promoting adoption of safer chemicals. Identifying the scope of effort that you can engage in is really important. In Massachusetts, we were very clear. We had a short period of time in which to do the work we were asked to do and not a lot of money with which to do it. And so we narrowed our scope really quickly, and that worked for us for our specific goal, which was to prove kind of that you can, in fact, identify safer alternatives to chemicals of concern. We were not looking to ban. When you're banning, you have most likely a much, if you're considering the possibility of banning, I should say, you most likely have a much broader scope where you want to really be engaging everybody and getting as deep a scope of information on the alternatives as possible. One of the important elements of defining the goal is to really be clear what it is you mean by the term safer. And so that would kind of be a webinar all unto itself. It's a discussion that needs to be had, though. What do you mean? What are your criteria that you use to assess whether or not an alternative is, in fact, safer? So identifying chemicals of concern is really an important first step. You need to know what the hazards are that you're concerned about. If there are specific hazard endpoints that you're more concerned about in your jurisdiction than others, that clarification can help you to identify which chemicals of concern you want to focus your work on. How chemicals are being used may be factors in helping you to identify which chemicals you want to focus on, and also exposures. So, again, in Massachusetts, when we went through this process, we really talked to stakeholders and heard a lot about their concerns about specific exposures that were happening currently. And so that helped us to identify which chemicals of concern we wanted to focus additional work on. So that's a process that needs to be gone through. And then you may need to further narrow your scope by not only identifying the uses associated with the chemical of concern, but also prioritizing those uses for further evaluation. So the ways that you can do that include evaluating what the functional uses are of the chemical of concern, what products it may be involved in, is it being used by an industry sector that is a priority for you? Other issues that should be considered are whether or not you have any information on the availability of alternatives. So if you have information that alternatives are not available currently, you may not want to be focusing your efforts on that, depending on the scope of your process. On the other hand, it provides a wonderful opportunity to promote research and development of safer alternatives. And again, exposure potential is really a key factor for a lot of jurisdictions in figuring out which uses of chemicals of concern they want to focus in on. Once you've gone through that process to sort of narrow your scope down, you know which uses of a priority chemical you're going to focus in on, you then can go into the process of identifying and then prioritizing alternatives for even more evaluation. It's a very intense research effort where you really want to scan the state of the practice, for that specific use, to identify whether there are chemical and non-chemical alternatives currently being used in practice, currently being researched, that may have, alternatives that may have been considered and thrown out for one reason or another. So this really involves, reviewing scientific literature, reaching out to trade associations, reaching out to specific companies, speaking with technical experts related to the use or the functional application of the chemical. It's a fairly labor-intensive process. But what you want to do is try to get as broad a scan of the suite of alternatives that may be available to you. And then screen out those that just really are not things you want to evaluate further. And, we say here screen out the bads. Well, in Massachusetts' case, what we did was anything that was a PBT or a CMR or on our Massachusetts list of more hazardous substances, we just said, those are not alternatives we're going to think about further. So those were the criteria that we had. You may have different criteria based, again, on what your goals and the scope of your project are. But your whole purpose here is to focus your subsequent evaluation on alternatives that look like most likely candidates for adoption. Because, again, in my opinion anyway, the purpose for doing alternatives assessment is to come up with solutions that industry can adopt to move that entire, to move their work away from toxic chemicals and towards a safer chemical, regime. Okay, so you've gone through these steps. You've identified several alternatives that look like they are worth considering further. And so now you want to do a much more in-depth data gathering effort to really get a complete picture of how well the alternatives might fare, not only from an environmental health and safety perspective, you know, are these alternatives in fact safer? And remember, that's a term that you probably want to put some effort and thought into defining for yourself. But importantly, in alternatives assessment, we go beyond comparing based solely on the chemical hazards to really engaging in looking at what are the technical and economic and social implications of switching to an alternative. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit more about technical feasibility and economic feasibility. I'm not going to get into social feasibility here in this webinar, but I think that, again, that's another place where we may want to have future discussions. So as you're going through this process, you may want to consider weighting your comparison. And so I'm going to kind of show you a couple of different ways that folks have done this kind of a comparison. One of the first things that's done in a comparison, again, is this comparative chemical hazards assessment. And so this is really looking at the environmental health and safety implications of the alternatives. There are a number of tools that have been developed over the years that are available for really looking at the intrinsic chemical hazards of the chemicals of concern and their chemical alternatives. So here, really, this focuses primarily on chemical alternatives. So here's a list of a number of different methods that have been developed over the years, from state methods to European Union methods, to EPA, Design for the Environment. We have NGOs here as well. And we'll give you just a kind of a brief glimpse at some of these. But this is also an opportunity for you to really engage in some life cycle thinking and exposure thinking around the alternatives. And so I can give you an example where life cycle assessment and life cycle thinking and exposure concerns come into play, but I'm gonna kind of move forward. This screenshot here, unfortunately, is a little blurry, but what it is it's from the evaluation that the DFE has done, and in this particular example, really, I just want to show you how DFE compared a variety of alternative flame retardants. And so you see that they're using letters low, moderate, and high. There's some use of color. And on the right-hand side, you can also see a little bit of kind of a more graphical way of thinking about where exposure considerations occur throughout the life cycle of the alternatives. And so this is just one sort of visual way of kind of scanning all of the deep, deep data that went into the assessment process itself. And so one of our challenges is how do we best display the comparative results of the work that we're doing so that industry can make decisions. This is another example, and it's created by Clean Production Action, a non-government organization. And this is an open source method that is continuing to evolve. They're engaging with a number of technical advisors to move towards a 2.0 version. Many people on the call here have been involved in one way or another on that work. What the green screen does is it gives you guidance and criteria to categorize the alternatives by benchmarks, going from benchmark one, which are chemicals that should be avoided. They are chemicals of high concern, to benchmark two, which are chemicals that you can use, but you should continue to search for safer substitutes because they're really not preferable alternatives. Benchmark three are those chemicals which, you know, you can go ahead and use, but there still are opportunities for improvement. So continuing to do the assessment process, continuing to look for safer alternatives is really recommended. And then really you want to find yourself moving towards benchmark four chemicals, and these are chemicals that are considered to be safer. So remember I said that when we're doing an alternatives assessment, we are not only doing a chemical comparative comparison of hazards. We're also wanting to look at whether or not an alternative provides a technically or economically feasible alternative. So in the technical evaluation, in order to really get tease out that question of is the alternative feasible technically, these are some of the considerations that you want to be thinking about. Of course, first, is the alternative actually available? So is it readily available off the shelf? Is it widely commercialized or not? That may affect whether or not an industry might consider it technically feasible. Is the alternative compatible with the existing technology? So for that particular use, is it something that could be used as a drop-in replacement? Is it something that would require significant capital expenditure or changes in process or procedures? These are considerations, again, that industry is particularly interested in as they consider switching. Will it cause any product quality issues that are of concern? Are there any long-term implications of the use of the alternative that should be considered? So, for instance, is it a very limited resource that may be available now but can't be guaranteed to be consistently available in the future? That, again, is something that companies would be looking for. And so really they're looking for flexibility and durability in their alternatives. When you assess the economic feasibility of an alternative, there's a number of different costs that can be considered, direct costs and savings, hidden costs. So are there insurance implications of using one alternative over another? Are there future liability concerns that may have a financial implication for companies? Non-monetized costs and benefits, are those elements that may be involved in things like, you know, your ability to reach out to a broader audience for a customer base, your ability to maintain good relations with your neighbors in the production area, et cetera. So there's a broad range of different non-monetized costs and benefits that could be associated with a switch to an alternative that companies would want to be considering. And then there's also this element of kind of change associated with the economics of switching. And that is that if you develop a market for an alternative because you've identified it as a safer alternative and create more demand, there can be an impact on the cost of that alternative. So that even though now it may seem to be significantly more expensive than the chemical of concern you're looking to replace, there's always the possibility that the market share could shift and that it can become more affordable in the future. So there's just a broad range of things to think about. And when you're thinking both about technical and economic feasibility, you want to be thinking about how do I get the information that will make the case to business that switching to a safer alternative really can be done. Okay, so selecting an alternative, this is something that typically is more appropriately done at the company level, but it's something that I think from our perspective, we really need to be considering. So how do we promote the selection of a specific alternative? So how you present the data can affect how users of that information move forward in selecting an alternative to switch to. But going through the process, you may also identify the fact that there are no really good alternatives, and so going through the process may actually bring up wonderful opportunities for research and development and for green chemistry. So that's an important part. So promoting the adoption of safer alternatives, that's really been the key from our perspective in Massachusetts. And I'll talk a little bit about how we've done that. I apologize for the way the slides look, but creating an implementation policy or providing support for implementation of moving towards the use of safer alternatives is something that I think from a policy perspective is something that we can and should be considering. There may be ways of providing incentives for companies to move towards safer chemicals, and there's a lot of opportunity here for promoting research, and because really industry can innovate if given the drive to do so, and I think that's one of our strengths here is being able to identify opportunities for further research that can lead to new markets and new alternatives that are in fact safer and help to promote economic viability of companies. So in Massachusetts, we've worked for 20 years with companies to move them away from their use of toxic chemicals, and we do that by promoting adoption of safer alternatives. The ways that we do that are we provide on-site technical support. We also provide funding for research into alternatives. We do technical evaluation of alternatives, working with companies and with researchers. We keep our eye on the latest innovations that may be out there and provide education and training so that companies are kind of up to speed on what their options may be. Because these things change with time. We do demonstrations of examples of success stories. We work directly with supply chains to get them working together. There's a lot of different ways that you can be working with your constituency to promote the adoption of safer alternatives and to really support them in doing so in a way that keeps them economically competitive. One of the other things that we do is we really do some policy research to make sure that what we're presenting to companies in Massachusetts is in fact relevant to them and relevant to the current kind of global policy situation. There are a lot of tools out there and available, and you can go to the IC2 saferalternatives.org website to find this kind of conglomeration of tools that provide data sources for environmental health and safety data, different uses, exposure data. And it also provides different tools for assessing and examples of alternatives. So I'm just going to wrap this up because I've gone over time. But again, benefits of alternatives assessment, it moves you away from chemicals of concern towards safer solutions, and you're really focusing on assessment and implementation. So Joel, do you want to go from here?
Yeah, I'll take it from there. Hold on here. I'm back to sharing here. Hopefully sharing will work here. So there are a number of challenges here in alternatives assessment, and so some of those...
I'll share, you talk.
Yeah, okay, you share, and some of those relate to lack of data that many agencies face. Some of them relate to performance of the alternatives. Some of them relate to the thinking that is often driven by regulatory demands of focusing on problems and not on solutions, and trying to get to that level of regulatory threshold for action, and some of them are focusing on those unique jurisdictions that different agencies face of you know needing to focus on workers or consumers or the environment, and their jurisdiction does not include the other parts, workers, environment, consumers. So there's many limits here, but there's plenty of opportunities going into the future. Pam, have you been able to get that back up here? Pam?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I had it shared. Let me try again.
Sorry about this technological new software we have. So the limits can be overcome by better collaboration between agencies and looking for opportunities for collaboration between agencies. And that is the purpose of this dialogue, is to begin that collaborative opportunity. So there's many opportunities for sharing experiences, sharing expertise, sharing case studies of successful implementation of alternatives, that we would like this to be the beginning of that process. And let me just give one example that Jean had, and then we'll go into Q&A. Jean had raised an example of discrete example of substitution, and let me just raise chlorinated solvents, particularly trichloroethylene in Massachusetts, used widely in degreasing operations and a chemical of high concern in the state of Massachusetts. So Massachusetts law requires both the materials accounting, understanding how that chemical is used every year, but then every 2 years of the planning process of looking at alternatives. Also, the Surface Solutions Laboratory at the Toxics Use Reduction Institute tested alternatives and evaluated those for companies to ensure that as they made that switch, that they weren't switching from a solvent that worked very well to something that didn't perform well or maybe more toxic. And being able to evaluate that resulted in about a reduction of 90% in the use of trichloroethylene in degreasing operations in Massachusetts. Now, the challenge came in part for many degreasers finding a drop-in substitute was what they wanted to have. And one of those drop-in substitutes that was promoted was N-propyl bromide, which is a strong neurotoxic and also a carcinogen. But it was a drop-in substitute that was not regulated. And this is where that sharing of experience between agencies is so critical to avoid those risk trade-offs and regrettable substitutions that can occur when we don't take a holistic view to alternatives assessment. So I'm going to stop there and then open up. Now everyone is back on, muted, and if there are particular questions, please raise them.
And I apologize about the screen sharing. I screwed up.
Is there someone trying to ask a question, but they can't be heard?
Okay.
Any questions about the presentation about how to implement alternatives assessment, or also topics you would like to hear on future webinars? I see one question. Jean had a question about formaldehyde in building products and furniture. And Pam, do you want to try and address that one?
So, there's been a lot of work in that area, and there's examples of building products that Columbia, I think it is, in Washington, has been using with soy-based products. One of the things in Massachusetts that we've done is we've used our alternatives assessment process to identify opportunities for additional research. And so we funded research looking at developing new resins to eliminate the use of formaldehyde in the binders used in many building products.
Friday night, I'm
not sure. So there are examples out there, but, ooh, look at that. I don't know if we're having a hard time hearing any questions, so maybe, Joel, we need to move
if
forward.
Yep, we can hear there.
What has been your experience in collaborations between industry or professional associations and government university organizations to try and move forward at the intersection of research and adoption?
I can speak to that a little bit from my perspective. So in Massachusetts, at the Toxics Use Reduction Institute, we try to really focus on specifically that, on getting industry to engage with researchers to identify their needs, their research needs. And we provide some small amount of state funding for the researchers to do, R&D into specific safer alternatives. So, for instance, one would be research that we've done over the past couple of years looking at non-halogenated flame retardants that could be used in textile or wire and cable applications that these flame retardants are being developed using a green chemistry approach. We've also funded some research looking at alternatives to BPA in epoxy resins. So what we've been able to do is identify industry needs and focus in with our researchers to address those problems.
Thanks.
There's a question in the discussion board. Talking about flame retardants, alternative data set from DFE is extremely rich with respect to various toxicities, but this is unusual. The current BPA alternatives assessment does not have toxicity data associated with the majority of compounds, necessitating reliance on structural models. How would you assess addressing this data gap in a cost-effective and high-throughput manner? And I would, Cal Bay or Anderson, if you're on the phone, is that something you might be able to answer?
Hi there. This is Cal Bayer Anderson from EPA Design for the Environment, and I agree that this is a huge obstacle. Here in DFE, we have access to experts who, for the past 30 years, have been evaluating chemicals under the New Chemicals Program, so they have extensive expertise doing structure activity relationship analyses on chemicals with very little data. But most agencies and organizations don't have access to that expertise. So from my point of view, the limited amount of information out there is it's a tremendous barrier to broader application of alternatives assessment methodologies. It's something that we're talking about internally. I'm not sure that I have solutions here. I think, we're looking at high-throughput screening as a potential alternative process for obtaining data, and we're exploring the utility of alternative test methods for these purposes, but at this point, there's no easy answers.
Great. Thank you, Cal. Other questions? There are no more questions. I think what we'll do is wrap up at this point. I'd like to thank you for your participation on the call. Our slides will be posted on the IC2 Wiki website. We will send a note out to the listserv when posted, along with the recording of the webinar. And if you are interested in the background paper that led to the meeting last year and is the basis of this presentation, please send me, Joel Tickner, an email, and we will send that to you. I'd like to thank you again for your participation. Particular questions, please send them, and we'll be able to answer them. In particular, if there are suggestions for future webinars, our plan is to have a webinar every 2 months from here on in. We'd like to thank you. Have a great day.